Talk given Sunday, 15th March 1981. Those of you who were present for our October meetings, especially the Sunday one, may remember that we dealt with a very, very important matter. We tried to see how the context of the transcendent, which is that of infinity, eternity, and immortality, is completely interwoven and completely interacts with the context of worldliness, the context of finitude, temporality, and mortality. The mortal and the immortal are completely interrelated with each other. You remember the simple example we took. If you think of a point has no measurements at all. No length, no breadth, no depth. It's only conceptual. And as such, therefore, it is non-finite. Infinite. The word infinity has two meanings. The infinity of bigness and the infinity of smallness. The point is the perfect expression of the infinity of smallness. Now, if you were to put millions of points side by side, you still won't get a line. But if that point were to move, and movement is a living action, remember, you will produce a line. Similarly, the movement of a line produces a surface, and a line, a point, a line, and a surface are all invisible. Our sense of sight begins to operate only as and when an infinite number of surfaces make a solid object. But every line, every surface, every solid object being three-dimensional, is finite. It comes into being in time and it perishes ultimately. It belongs to the realm of mortality, to the realm of death. But, as we just saw, infinity is involved in the production of these things. And therefore, the context of the infinite and the context of the finite are completely interrelated with each other. It's one of the mysteries, the marvels of existence. How on earth the Lord God managed to produce a universe of that sort is a most extraordinary thing. It really is very, very extraordinary. And it is also very, very extraordinary in its effect upon our own minds and our own capacity to perceive deeply into the nature of everything. Not only things which belong to the world of the finite and the mortal, things which are separate, but also things as if we may use such a word, in the context of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. And we also saw that both time and timelessness are completely subsumed within eternity. Eternity holds both, and immortality rides on the wings of mortality. Because if one is completely attentive to the immediate moment, which is the passing mortal moment, the life-death pulse, then in consciousness you are living immortally. Consciousness never dies in that process. Whereas in the ordinary processes of life, consciousness undergoes death, because one associates the self with the ending of a state of mind or feeling, with any action or with any process, etc., which is taking place in the world. Now, it is extremely important to be able to penetrate into this. Don't try to penetrate it analytically. Don't try to analyze it. Try and get the feel of the whole. The feeling aspect is the aspect which is true awareness. The intellectual analytical side is, of course, the ordinary discriminative consciousness process. We have to transcend the discriminative consciousness process in order to realize immortality, and it can only be realized here and now. Now, if we have begun to understand the complete interrelationship of these two contexts as such, then we shall be free of innumerable illusions and delusions about our nature, our existence, our future, and all the rest of it. We think in terms of living a life here of 60, 70 years, and then there is death, and then we don't know. We have heard say that, oh, you come back again into life and have another life. What is this you that comes back? You'll never find that you. There is no you to come back. You have heard it said that either you'll go to heaven if you're a good boy, and if you're not a good boy, you get to the warm place. All those fantasies and illusions disappear altogether. And the extraordinary freedom in which one lives thereafter is something to be experienced. Now remember, you cannot merely think out this interaction of the context of the transcendent and of the worldly, the world of death and the world of immortality. You cannot just think it out. All your thinking out will raise up innumerable questions and arguments, and you will just find yourself in a state of confusion. Let the mind be quiet and just be sensitive to the actuality of the immediate present. And gradually there will emerge in your own consciousness a dormant capacity which will make you realize what precisely does it feel like to be infinite, that is to say immeasurable, to be eternal and to be immortal. They are all here and now. Now I mention this because today I want to try and deal with another very, very important matter. We are all interested in our future. If we really honestly look into our own minds, we shall find that there is this hidden longing for fruition and fulfillment, all of which we define in our own limited and absurd terms. You will find that generally speaking, we live in a remarkable state of delusion, and we preserve that illusory condition, that condition of Maya. We are the makers of that Maya, and we are the preservers of that Maya, and we pay the penalties for doing that. Now, you know how the great spiritual teachers of the world, all of them without exception, and especially the founders of the great religions, they had realized transcendence. Now, where and when did they realize transcendence? They realized it here while living in a body in this world, on this earth. And they realized it during their lifetime. Within the time process, they realized eternity, immortality, and infinity. And they knew how to relate it completely to the ordinary finite, temporal, and mortal process of the world, because when consciousness was fully enlightened in that manner, they could see the true relationships existing between any one thing and everything else in the universe. That is why. Now, having realized that state, They did not produce systems of philosophy based on preconceived premises. They wiped that out altogether. They simply made affirmations about transcendence. And they made affirmations about transcendence rather than about the worldly state for the very simple reason that the entire worldly process of finitude and mortality is subsumed in transcendence itself, is subsumed within infinity and eternity and immortality. Completely subsumed. It is out of the transcendent that the non-transcendent, if we may use that term, is expressed, pressed out of. And it is back into that transcendence that the non-transcendence gets reabsorbed. Now, it gets reabsorbed not in terms of finite entities. This is the great thing to bear in mind. Our concept of I am I, or you are you, and that I will have a place in that transcendent world is sheer illusion. There is no entity preservation at all. The infinite cannot be parceled up. The immortal cannot be reduced to the state of mortality. I talked of two contexts. For the very simple reason that we, being constituted as we are, cannot speak at all unless we use the language of duality. And if and when we can negate duality in the right manner, then only we are truly conscious of the unitary wholeness. It's very important to grasp this. It is the consciousness of the unitary wholeness which is the actual fact throughout eternity. But we being constituted as we are and not yet being capable of that consciousness of unitary wholeness, all our thinking process and all our expressing process, that is to say all our conceptualizing and verbalizing, must of necessity submit to the restrictions imposed upon us by the duality of existence and the multiplicity of it. You see? Just by listening to the words, merely by saying, I believe what you say, nothing happens. All that is just completely impotent. It is you yourself who grow into this state. Now, this kind of realization of the fulfillment, the nature of the fulfillment, was expressed by the great spiritual teachers who had themselves realized a transcendence. It was expressed in so many ways, and I've called the ways in which they expressed it as the promise. They made the affirmations and they gave the promise. In the Gita, Sri Krishna says, "He who serveth me unfailingly by the yoga of devotion, he crossing beyond the qualities, is fit to become Brahman." And remember, crossing beyond the qualities, you may ask, what does that mean? It simply means this, that everything which is finite and mortal, which belongs to the realm of death, is distinguishable because of its qualities. And therefore, you cross completely beyond all the qualities when you really sense the transcendent. You are free of any sort of restriction imposed by qualities, and that saves you from making a million choices which are all still forces to confine you to the realm of the mortal and will not allow you to be liberated into the state of the immortal. Remember that immortality does not mean that the body will not die. Every one of the great teachers died. Physically you die, yes, of course, but here and now in mind and consciousness you truly realize what immortality means, and because of that realization your entire life, your states of mind, your feelings, your words, your actions, they all become entirely different. And your interrelationship with the entire world becomes a totally different kind of interrelationship. It is only then that you can be truly compassionate and truly wise. Then transcendent love and transcendent wisdom and goodness and beauty and purity and truth, they all function freely through you. Do it, realize it, and you will see that I have not taken you up the primrose path. It's not easy to realize it. Do remember that. So going beyond the qualities is fit to become Brahman. And Brahman, as you know, means the absolute all. Though ever performing all actions, the holy ones, however holy, they perform actions in the world. Though ever performing all actions, taking refuge in me, by my grace he obtaineth the eternal changeless abode. Now he's talking to Sri Krishna, he's talking to Arjuna, and he's talking here and now in the world. One body talking to another body. Merge thy mind in me. Here is the critical verse. Be my devotee, sacrifice to me, prostrate thyself before me. Thou shalt come even unto me. I pledge thee my troth. Thou art dear to me. And when the incarnate Lord of the world says thou art dear, it means something tremendous. Abandoning all other paths, come unto me alone for shelter. Sorrow not, I will liberate thee from all sins. Notice carefully, come to me alone. The transcendent, all transcendence is the alone. The alone meaning not lonely, but the one only. It is the emphasis upon the unity of the universe in every sense. So come to me alone, and when you yourself realize that that type of consciousness, that mode of awareness of your existence, then you will find your own true aloneness. You are the one only, and in your being the one only, you are the absolute all. This is something which has to be experienced. One can't argue a thing like that. One can't offer proofs for it. Realize that state, and there you are. That's it, so to say. Zarathustra said, whoever follows the teacher of holiness, his dwelling shall be the light. To him who is the friend of the Supreme, Ahura Mazda will grant, note carefully, will grant perfection and immortality. And he's talking of you here now, whilst alive in the body, in the mortal condition, will grant perfection and immortality. And out of his abundance, righteousness, purity as well, and through his own overflowing strength, his might and majesty. His might and majesty meaning that creative power which belongs to the primordial creative energy as such, which brings forth the entire universe and reabsorbs it. And the firm support of his good mind. The mind again. Remember the words of the Buddha? Cease to do evil, strive to do good, purify the mind, that is the way of the Buddhas. So there you are. It's all here and now. And the Buddha also emphasized in his very first sermon after the enlightenment, he tells the five people who were present, hearken bhikkhus, hearken monks, the deathless has been found. Here was a man, a living man, 35 years of age, saying the deathless has been found. And he adds, going along in accordance with what is enjoined, having soon realized here and now by your own super knowledge, having realized here and now, not in any mythical hereafter. Here and now, by your own super-knowledge, that supreme goal of living the holy life, for the sake of which young men of family rightly go forth from home into homelessness, you will abide in it. Heaven is here, right now. And the words of Jesus, and this will be more or less the subject of our considerations today. If a man love me, he will keep my words, and my Father will love him, and we will come unto him and make our abode with him. Notice the enormity of that statement. If a man love me, he will keep my words. That sounds simple enough. But just wait and see what happens when we come to consider it. And my Father will love him, the Father God who is the creator of everything and so on and so on. My Father will love him, and we, the Father and the Son, will come unto him and make our abode in him. They will live inside you yourself as you are and function freely through you. Now, if a man love me, does any one of us truly know what love is? Our mortal conception of love and our mortal practice of love is hedged in with possessiveness, with jealousy, with envy, with conditionality, and so forth, isn't it? I will love you if. And if you go beyond that point, then goodbye. Isn't that so? This is our conception of love and so forth. We can go beyond that and sort of deliberately endure that which we find a little bit difficult with the loved one, for love's sake, as we say, or for friendship's sake. We'll put up with that. Put up with that. Now, whatever we put up with means that there is no true and perfect interrelationship present. Therefore, it is not love. If there is jealousy, if there is envy, if there is a demand that my friend shall or my beloved shall do this, that and the other for me and so forth, all that bedevils love right at the very source. Love is not love which alteration finds or something. Isn't that in Shakespeare? One of the sonnets? Consider then carefully what love could possibly mean. Is not love in the true sense, in its actuality and reality, its ultimate reality, is it not a total and a complete giving of the whole of oneself to the loved one without any conditions, without any restrictions or impositions of any sort, without any demand? When a man and a wife can love each other in that manner, then their marriage is the expression on earth, the real expression on earth of the marriage made in heaven. But how difficult it is to give in this total and complete manner. It is not an easy task at all, is it? Absolutely unconditional and unreserved, unreserved giving of oneself. And if one, assuming that one has the capacity to do that, then one does not give it just to one person alone. Then there are no distinctions whatsoever. The beloved is every other single person in the world, and it is every other thing in the whole universe. You give your love, or shall I put it a better way, that transcendent love flows through your psychophysical being into the universe, without let or hindrance. Now something like that is love. the divine love, the transcendent love. And if there is love of that sort, you will see at once that there is no possibility of an acceptance through preferential choice of any one person or thing. There is no rejection at all of anyone or anything because of a reaction of aversion or disappointment or whatever it is. In such love, there is no room for hopes, for expectations, for demands, for fulfillments, no room for the idea of pleasure or having a joyful time or anything like that. It is a blissful state, and the blissful state is an utterly peaceful state. Nothing shakes the immovable peace of that condition. It is the great peace that passes all understanding. Something like that, perhaps, is the nature of love. Now, what is one of the implications of that kind of complete giving? The implication is that there is no longer any selfness in that person. If there is any selfness in me, there will be a center inside me, which is the I am I. And that center, by being the limited, the finite and the mortal center, will inevitably make demands upon what is outside its own sphere. You see? It means, therefore, a selflessness in the supreme sense. But how does one realize selflessness in the supreme sense? What is involved in that? What is involved there is one of the most important factors in the process of our spiritual fulfillment. It is the complete freedom from the consciousness of oneself as a separate, isolated entity. When self-consciousness has become utterly free of all isolativeness with respect to all human beings, and of all separativeness with respect to all things, then you are no longer conscious of yourself as a particular, separate, identifiable entity as such. When you are conscious in that manner, then where are you? What is the you? You become the everything. You try and do it, practice it. See if you can. Don't fool yourself in the practice. This is one of the great things you must be aware of. It's very easy to fool ourselves, and then people who have done that do dreadful things in the world, and deceive others in consequence. But when you can do that, you will find that with the disappearance of the self-consciousness as a separate, particular, identifiable entity takes place, then you are the one alone, the one only. And in that consciousness of the one only, you are in complete and right relationship with everyone and everything in the world. Now notice, the consciousness of it I talk of, not a state of mind, not holding a particular thought. Oh yes, yes, we are all brothers, we are all ancestors, we are all one. These are words, and we may hold it as a thought, and such thoughts and words are completely impotent. They have no actual power in them. So it means that state of consciousness. When you are really conscious of something, the brain won't know it. If you are truly conscious of transcendent love, your brain will not know it. Others will see the manifestation of that consciousness in your every thought and feeling, in your word and in your action. Others will be able to see that because they see as from the outside as separate beings. But you won't know it. If anybody were to tell you that you are like this, you are the embodiment of transcendent love, you will start wondering, what's he talking about? I never knew that. You see, the I has disappeared. That's the point. And with the disappearance of that I, there is only immortal light everywhere. So, it is a consciousness which, if I may use such a phrase, is an unknowing knowing. It is an unknowing knowing. The title of a book called The Cloud of Unknowing is somewhat representative of this state of consciousness. And do realize that your state of consciousness is something which the brain never knows. It is the wellspring out of which emerge all your states of mind, as we call them, your feelings, your intellectual processes, your emotional processes, and so forth. You see? So these are the implications of love. Now, if a man love me, he will keep my words. Now, what is the meaning of he will keep my words? Of course, the obvious meaning is he will try to live in accordance with the teachings, with the simple rules of morality, and so on. Alright, he will keep my words. But does the perfected Holy One use the word words or the word in that sense? What are our words? They are representative of things, actions, states which are finite, temporal, and mortal. That is what words are. They confine us to the realm of death, of limitation, of constriction. Those are words. And thoughts, all our thoughts, similarly, are of that nature. They follow, the conceptual and the verbal processes go together. If it is not, if the thoughts don't follow the verbal process, they will only follow either the oral process, you will hear a succession of sounds, or you'll see a succession of pictures, and so on and so on. But that means that your thinking process is completely the slave of all your sense functioning as such. And all your sense functioning can only produce various images of the reality, of the ultimate reality. You don't know the ultimate truth or reality in terms of your sense perceptions alone. The brain synthesizes yourself, your sense perceptions. And synthesizing is a mechanical process. The brain doesn't integrate what happens. The integrative process comes later, as and when the sense of transcendence awakens within your inner consciousness. And then this integrative process takes place. And the whole of your thinking and speaking and everything gets completely altered. The finest works of the greatest geniuses throughout the world, they are somewhat representative of what I'm trying to suggest here. You see, this integrative process. The integrative process is a living process. It's a process of growth. It's a process of emergence out of the limited, enabling our divine potentiality to come to full fruition and flowering. That is integration. You plant an acorn, and the acorn becomes an oak tree. The becoming of that full oak tree is an integrating process all the time. It's not a mechanical putting together of so many cells or whatever is involved in the coming into being of an oak tree. Now, we must remember all that very, very carefully. That's why I started off with asking you to recall that October meeting when we talked of the two contexts, the context of the transcendent and the context of the finite and the mortal. You see, they interact with each other. And because of that interaction, this process of growth, this process of live integration can take place. And this is very, very important. So now, words, come back to words. The perfected Holy One has quite a different meaning for the word word. You know how St. John's Gospel starts. And by the way, that passage I quoted from about Jesus is from St. John's Gospel. It's chapter 14, verse 23. It's there. How St. John starts his Gospel by saying, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God." Now, obviously, there was no language. God did not speak any of the languages which we human beings speak. And he did not need to speak such words or interesting. Otherwise, we would just make God a kind of a glorified film star. A man. A human being. Which is utterly nonsensical. The beginning was the Word. The Word was God. And the Word was with God. And it is this Word which is the creative energy, the primordial creative energy, which produces the entire cosmos as such. The Word releases itself. Now, therefore, we must look elsewhere to find some sort of understanding of this Word, the Word. It comes in all the great religions. If you look into the Trismegistic writings, you will find this kind of phrase, the thought in the mind of God. Now we know what our thinking is, a string of impotent words, more or less. That is our thinking. Our thoughts are just like that. So many, the bulk of them are all illusions and delusions and so forth. And the bulk of them are not exactly utterly pure. So much for our thoughts as such. You see, in our minds, what we call our minds, really we should call them, refer to our own psyche, not mind, because mind is the universal archetypal form through which the primordial creative energy functions in order to release cosmos out of chaos. That is the final meaning of the word mind. Now, our minds are not that. When we say mind, we mean our ordinary intellectual and emotional processes and states and so forth, our incessant chatter which goes on, especially in the left side of the brain, and that sort of thing. And that is all we mean by mind. We don't mean this creative energy, this creative power. If we meant that, and if we knew what that was like, we would only have to think something, and it would immediately be there. Because that kind of thinking is the creative power, which releases manifestation out of the unmanifest. Now, the perfected Holy Ones know that meaning of the word mind. And the thought in the mind of God refers to something utterly transcendent to what we mean by thought and mind. So, the word, therefore, expresses something which belongs to that realm. This creative energy which in action produces a cosmos. And a cosmos is a great harmony, is an efficient and a great harmony as such. Very good. He will keep my words. Now try and understand. If a man love me, He will keep my words. And my Father will love him. Now, Jesus knew all about the original teachings of the Kabbalah and so forth, which are the source. Those teachings are the source of the entire Judeo-Christian tradition and teachings. My Father in heaven. The Father is Abba. And Abba really means that which emerges out of the unknown and the unknowable, the absolute, the ultimate. That is Abba. You know, like as Eckhart put it, there is Gottheit, the utterly unspeakable, the unknowable. And out of Gottheit, the projection of Gottheit is Gott. Is God, the creative agent, as such. It was anthropomorphized, of course, in presenting it that way. So now, my Father in heaven, heaven is Chokhmah, and Chokhmah means wisdom. It is the wisdom aspect of the Supreme. So my Father will love him. The transcendent and the finite are in complete interaction and interrelationship thereby. Will love him. And we, the Father and the Son, therefore, will come and make our abode with him, will live with him. What does that mean in actual fact then? That which is meant by the Son of God, and that which is meant by the Father God, are two of the supreme expressions of this primordial creative energy, which is also absolute consciousness at the same time, and bliss, Sat-Chit-Ananda. You see, absolute consciousness and bliss. This will begin to function in and through you. Now notice, all the great teachers in some form or other taught this kind of thing. And these are the implications of it. Our potentiality is God. We are gods in the making, in the very real sense. You know how Pythagoras, in the Golden Verses, was responsible for this statement. And when, after having divested thyself of the mortal body, that does not mean after you're dead or have killed off your body, but it means after having released your consciousness from the limitations imposed by awareness of the mortal body as such, thou arrivest at the most pure ether. Thou shalt be a god, immortal, incorruptible, and death shall have no more dominion over thee. Death shall have no more dominion over your consciousness. Your consciousness will not fluctuate between and be the prisoner of the activity of duality or multiplicity. Your consciousness shall be one and whole. If thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. There is the meaning, if you like. You see? And Pythagoras said that. It's verses 70 and 71 of the Golden Verses. So now we see what the implications are of the promise as presented by Jesus. It's an extraordinary implication, isn't it? And what is the fundamental basis of it all? All the great teachers, again, are in harmony with regard to the basis of it. It's the living of the pure life. Zarathustrianism, Ashoi, Asha, righteousness, purity. And it also stands for the law of living, the law which is inherent in each and every person and thing in the universe. The universe is so made that every single aspect of it holds this power in potentiality there. And it is a power which does not compel. It is a power which draws you. Because there is transcendent love and wisdom embodied in it. If there is compulsion, there is conflict, there is evil. But if there is no compulsion, but there is transcendent love and wisdom, then it draws you and makes you grow in this life integrative way into goodness and truth and beauty and supreme happiness, bliss. It's something quite extraordinary. So the living of the pure life is the essential basis of it, or of it all. Leave everything else alone, but give your energy to the living of the pure life in thought, feeling, in word, and in deed. And then certainly all the promises made by the great teachers will be fulfilled through you.